FunShack Podcast is produced by Linear B Group, the leader in content, editorial, and marketing services to the investment industry. You're listening to FunShack. I'm Ross Butler, and today my guest is Chris Field, a partner at global law firm Deckert. This podcast is in two parts. First, we talk about what's happening in international private equity markets, including the innovations in deals being seen given the challenging climate, as well as structural changes. And then we take a fascinating dive into the world of private equity lawyering and what it takes to make it as a top M&A lawyer. Enjoy. Chris, welcome to FunShack. It's a funny time in the global M&A and private equity markets at the moment. You can see the tumbleweed's been blowing across for about a year now. You'd imagine that private equity executives' desks are very tidy indeed. Their pencils are all sharp. But what are you seeing?
Well, first of all, before we talk about what I'm seeing, Ross, thank you so much for having me on your show. Delighted to be here. What am I seeing? We were talking about this actually just before the show started, weren't we? And we were saying that there are potentially green shoots, but people want more than green shoots because who knows where that goes. So my exact analogy now is green shoots with little buds on them. And the question is, do they actually turn into full bloom? Or is it another false dawn? And it's very hard to say. I mean, I think sentiment is definitely up at the moment and right at the moment. My sense is coming into 2024, there was a lot of positive sentiment. I think the market as a whole was very focused on a number of rate cuts, particularly in the US, which really drives, but also across the EU and Bank of England. And I think that drove a lot of positive sentiment. My sense was there was a bit of a pause as it became clear that although there are likely to be rate cuts, it's not clear exactly when they will be and how many they will be. But as we sit here today on Monday morning, I think the sentiment is up again. So all things being equal, it looks like it's going to be a better year than last year.
Yeah, it's obviously very interest rate driven.
Correct. We produce a report once a year, which kind of surveys the state of the private equity market. It's pretty comprehensive. We can talk about that as well. And interestingly, the single biggest response in terms of what is the biggest challenge for the next 12 months looking out was interest rates. That was over a quarter of respondents. That was the largest individual share said they will have the single biggest impact. Interest rates will have the single biggest impact on the deal environment over this next 12 months.
It sounds to me a little bit like people looking in the rearview mirror and it's like when things are going to get back to normal, but who knows what normal is, you know, and things will have to get moving again, but not necessarily at the rates people want. You know?
That's exactly right. So I'll talk a few figures now, not specific figures, I'm a lawyer, but general trend figures. So here's an interesting thing that everyone's talk about the large drop in percentage terms in deal volume and deal value, in particular deal value, you know, and don't quote me on this. There are plenty of sites that will give you the exact figures, but broadly, over the last 12 months, you've looked at around high 20s, maybe even 30% drop in deal volume and an even more precipitous drop in deal value, kind of, you know, in the mid 40s, 45%, which is pretty eye-opening when you look at it that way. But here's the interesting thing. If you take 2019 as what I call it, the last undisturbed year, pre-pandemic, and you look at the figures then versus the figures in this last year, both by volume and interestingly, even by value, we are outperforming 2019. 2023 outperformed 2019.
It doesn't feel like that though, does it?
It doesn't. But I think really people have short-term memories. And when you think about the absolute intensity of activity that was going on through 2021 coming into 2022, you know, sort of first half of 2022 was some of the highest figures when people track this data on record for deal value and deal volume. So when you look at that compared with a year or 18 months later, it feels much slower. But in the grander cycle of things, there's a sense that maybe we are just settling into a sort of more measured cadence consistent with the pre-pandemic norm.
Do you know how that compares with funds raised and therefore dry powder? Because I, you know, anecdotally, I feel like a lot of my clients are doing much less than they were. So I wonder if a ton of money was raised. And so while levels are kind of looking good compared to 2019, in terms of how much could be being done, it's not that great.
There are a number of different things going on there. So one, as an ongoing trend, we've actually been tracking it over about the last 4 or 5 years. And if anything, it's accelerated. And that is the bifurcation in the fundraising market. You know, very much capital is being sucked into the largest multi-strategy managers at the expense, particularly of brand new funds, but also to a certain extent to much smaller funds. And so unless you're in that large multi-strategy tier, I think your day-to-day experience is a far more difficult one.
Yeah, so on that point, I read your report. One of the things that struck me is the number of GPs, private equity firm managers, looking at selling a stake in their in their own business.
GP stake sales.
And the reason I bring that up is because you're talking about size. And that is, that's a trend of like agglomeration. Things are just getting bigger. So the first thing is, I think the figure was something like almost two-thirds of managers are thinking about that.
That's right. Almost 60%. And I think there are a number of things. You know, historically, people have always thought about GP stake sales as a succession planning tool. And when you look at the private equity industry, it's a relatively young industry. It's maybe, 40? In its current form, it's maybe 40 years old, say. So there is clearly a generational shift, and you've seen that in the market. And so a GP stake sale is a nice way to provide liquidity to founders of private equity firms and ensure continuity of the firm. I think these days people also think about GP stake sales as achieving other things, such as putting liquidity, which is somewhat scarce at the moment, putting liquidity into the firm itself. And that liquidity can be used for all sorts of things. It can be used to grow the firm. And we've talked about already the benefits of scale in the current market. To be used to grow the firm, you could distribute it to LPs who've been really bereft of liquidity over the last 12 to 18 months. You can incentivize your juniors, you know, with the average size of funds growing year on year, it is difficult to make your own GP commitments. So how do you help fund that next generation? So there are many different things you could do with the proceeds from the GP stake sale. But I think the other big area, is it allows you to bring in external expertise. And so operationally, if you're thinking of moving into a new strategy or you just want a different skill set or an enhanced skill set or deal sourcing, whatever it may be, you can bring another very active participant alongside you who's now literally invested in your success. So I think people are looking at GP stake sales from many different angles now rather than historically the way they've been thought about.
What does an industry look like that where large private equity firms have a stake in all of the small private equity firms? But how does it work?
You know, my sense of the industry, and it's a function of a maturing industry, is that size matters. And when you look at the industry, you see the continued growth, as I call them, the multi-strategy managers. Tied into that is there's been a push toward turning them into public vehicles. And the public markets, as we all know, are very much focused on assets under management. Carry is less interesting to them. And so then the quest becomes, how do you grow AUM? And so that creates a very different type of organization in terms of how it's set up. And at the same time, if you look at the, for lack of a better term, traditional asset managers, the long-only asset managers, they have their own issues that they're navigating, which has partly been driven by the rise of passive investing and the fee compression that's resulted from that and the rise of ETFs and the further fee compression. And alternatives is clearly an area where there is more flexibility on fees. And so there is a large drive, and you've seen a number of transactions recently from the large asset managers to move into the alternative space. And so in that sense, there's this convergence that's going on at the top end of the market, which makes for very different organizations to the small founder-led LBO shops that were the origin of the industry.
You can compare this in some ways to the Big Bang in the UK in the 1980s, where regulatory change meant that all the American firms came in and they bought out all the little broker dealerships. But it's like, that's a market that benefits from scale. And so those little dealerships, they just went kind of overnight and suddenly it was just Goldman Sachs and some of the big European ones. But private equity isn't quite like that. There is an element that's not that scalable, that these mid-market firms, they do have a strong brand name and they've got a real franchise in their part of the market. And so I can't imagine that they're just going to get swallowed up.
I agree. I think it's like every market just continues to evolve. But if you look across a mature market, you're going to have some large dominant players at the top end of the market. But you're still going to have some very, very successful smaller, two types of smaller firm specialists. And you can have some super successful specialists. If you look in tech, people like Thoma Bravo and Vista Equity, you know, who've grown immensely, very specialist in an area which is, you know, conducive to fast growth. But equally, you're going to have some very successful operators within their particular segment of the market, whether that's low mid-market or mid-market, or a particular area, geographically, sector focus, whatever it may be, you know, they're going to continue and they're going to thrive. I think the difficulty is going to be those who don't have a really good USP. But that's always been the case in any market, hasn't it?
So presumably everyone's getting a little bit more of a breather right now. We're towards the end of Q1 2024. But what are you seeing in terms of, you mentioned the green shoots with the buds. So presumably that's conversations, deals that could happen.
Yes.
What are you seeing in terms of trends around those deals and the structure?
Yeah. So one of the really big issues, and this was probably more rather than 2023, more 2022, was the valuation gap. And uncertainties around valuation between seller and buyer. Excuse me, you know, seller expectations and ways that buyers were saying we just cannot bridge that gap. And so the past 12 months has really been about finding creative mechanics to bridge the gap. And so what we're seeing is a lot more use of deferred consideration mechanics, and in particular, earnouts are back in favor. Interestingly, promote the report again, 92% of respondents, that's a staggering figure, 92% said they were intending to increase their use of earnouts. It's purely about bridging the valuation gap. But it isn't just earnouts, you know, vendor loan notes, any form of deferred mechanic that it gives you the opportunity as the buyer to really understand, once you've acquired control of the company, what it is and how it's operating, with some ability, even if it isn't entirely contractual, some negotiating leverage to reprice as a consequence. So, I think a lot of creativity around there. But also what that does, using those deferred consideration mechanics, is allow the seller to maintain the same headline price that they want to achieve. You know, can go back to investors and say, we have achieved the headline price, with the consequent return multiples that they need.
In your past, because you've seen a few cycles, how often do these, is there a clawback? Does this actually come to pass?
I have never worked on an earnout ever that has not resulted in some form of dispute. I'm not saying that they all go to litigation at all, but I've never worked on an earnout where you've got to the point where the earnout is tested and whatever the requisite financials are delivered to show that the earnout has been achieved, and the other side go, yep, that's absolutely right, it's time to pay out on it.
Wow, so it's a messy business.
It's very messy. And you know, the difficulty is it's one thing having, say, a revenue-linked earnout. When you get into earnouts that are linked to profit, earnings, you know, way down the balance sheet, it just becomes so much more complicated. And so you do spend, and I'm not sure people recognize this, the amount of time that you spend as advisors, not just the lawyers, but also bringing in the financial advisors and the accounting advisors, you spend a lot of time trying to minimize the risk of that dispute arising. And so how do you work out all of the different metrics to make sure that there is no dispute around the underlying data that's coming in to validate the earnout? And that's before you talk about, you know, difficulty with the earnout is there are different incentives by different people involved in the business. All things being equal, the buyer would far prefer not to have to pay it.
Of course.
Often with earnouts, you find you have sellers that are still in some way still invested in the business, if it's a founder or it's a management team or whatever it may be, and they're clearly incentivized to achieve the earnout. And
a whole load of conflicts of interest there. Yeah.
And then also when you look at the actual exiting seller, you know, they want to make sure that the buyer does not exploit its position as the new owner of the business to ensure that the earnout is never achieved. So they're going to want to put a lot of restrictions around the ongoing operation of the business to ensure that that earnout has the best likelihood of being achieved, some of which may not be compatible with the buyer's vision as to how it's going to grow the business. And so how do you know? So yes, lawyers like earnouts from that perspective. I'm not sure clients should as much.
Yeah, I'm just to play devil's advocate slightly. I mean, a lot of these transactions will be private equity to private equity. And I just wonder whether that's really what private equity managers are paid to do. You know, I'm paid to assess a company and be diligent, but I'm going to pay the insurance industry to provide me with some kind of package, or the lawyers, just in case I'm wrong. You know, and if you aggregate that across the entire private equity industry, I'm not sure investors are getting the best deal for individual managers to hedge their bets against other individual managers.
I'm sure you've had on your program plenty of discussion around the benefits and disadvantages of transaction level secondaries, you know, or sometimes people slightly derogatory call them pass the parcel deals. To be fair to them, and we touched on this right at the start of the program, you know, you have firms operating in very different parts of the market. And so if you look at the evolution of a business as it matures, there is a logic to this because it isn't just simply passing it on, it's actually allowing it to go into new ownership, which has the right scale and operational skills at that point in the company's evolution to really kick on from there.
I completely buy that. I think that's part of the thing about private equity not being scalable. You need different organizations and managers and cultures for different stages of evolution.
It comes back to a bigger point. Quite often when you have people who are antagonistic around the private equity industry, is sometimes they're not comparing apples to apples. You know, I very, very rarely, if ever, hear somebody say, listed companies, they're terrible. Just as a concept, listed companies are terrible. Of course, that's not the case. So you can't be saying the same thing in respect of private equity. There are very different participants in very different parts of the market using very different mechanics and skills and approaches and operations and whatever it may be, who are all lumped together under the banner private equity. It's not fair to tar them all with the same brush at all. I think you need to be more sophisticated when you look at the industry and look at who's operating where within it. And like any industry, there's going to be good and there's going to be bad. I mean, it's all bad.
Okay, well, I completely agree with that, so I can't ask any more questions on it.
This is a safe space, isn't it?
Totally is, I'm afraid. Going back to doing deals, there's been a lot of kind of innovation in the world generally. You know, there's an app for everything. There's an AI for everything. Yes. Much innovation in the world of private equity transactioning?
I think there is a lot of innovation that we've seen over the last year or two under the snappily titled tagline, Alternative Liquidity Solutions. And this is, with the relative dearth of exits, what other ways can you find to return liquidity to your investors? And obviously, as we know, that's fundamental because you can't drive the fundraising cycle unless you're returning liquidity. And so we've seen the rise of or the use of subscription lines, which have been out there for a long time for new and innovative approaches, but then the rise of NAV facilities, more structured variants like collateralized fund obligations. We touched on the use of GP stake sales as a way to help drive liquidity. Vast growth in GP-led secondaries. You know, so if you're looking at fund-level secondaries, that used to be somewhat of a dirty word, didn't it? If all else fails, engage in a secondary. That is no longer the case at all, and particularly because they've been led by GPs now. To stat from the report, in 2012, GP-led secondaries represented 1% of the market for secondaries. They're now 40%. And all of that, that innovation across all of those things that I touched on, is to ensure that liquidity can be returned to investors. So that is innovative. That's super creative when you step back and look at it.
Yeah, that's amazing because you think of private equity as a sophisticated market, but that wasn't wrought by some regulatory change. You could have done that at any point. It's just a kind of a cultural change, like what's acceptable and what isn't, I guess.
But I think it's all economics, isn't it? It's responding to the economic environment in which you find yourself and addressing the need that environment presents. In this case, how do you return liquidity?
What about the regulatory environment?
So perversely, this has become good for lawyers. It is a more challenging regulatory environment. We've all seen that with both antitrust and, as I mentioned before, foreign direct investment, and a lot of that driven around national security. So we look at the US, if we look on antitrust, you know, the FTC has continued with its very emboldened approach. They, in particular, are focused on private equity, if I could call it that, as an industry, what they refer to as roll-ups. So effectively add-ons to create a dominant position within an industry. Very, very focused on that. And the full effect of that is yet to be felt because the new FTC and DOJ antitrust rules that are being proposed have yet to come into force. Europe and the UK is not quite as focused on private equity per se, but they're definitely focused on tech. We've seen that. And you've seen things like even the UK the UK's always had its own antitrust authority, the CMA, but historically they've been subsumed within the EU post-Brexit. They're now a separate regulator that needs its own clearance and can create issues on deals such as Microsoft, Activision, Blizzard, which they, you know, themselves unilaterally blocked until some sort of remedies and acceptable proposal was made. So we've certainly seen that. And then, you know, almost every political grouping is enacting some form of national security-driven foreign direct investment oversight. So the US CFIUS, which has been around for a long time, has become far more interventionist. It's clearing fewer deals. It's launching more investigations. The UK now has its National Security and Investment Act in force. The EU has brought in the foreign subsidies regulation, which is an interesting one because what it's trying to do is to track foreign government investment into Europe. And when you think of the number of sovereign wealth funds that are very large and active participants in the private capital industry, you know, that is creating, again, further complexity in terms of clearing conditions to be able to complete a deal.
And isn't it more about information flow rather than ownership when it comes to these type of risks? I don't know.
From a regulatory perspective, yes. Regulators want insight and visibility on what's happening.
What I meant was, if they're trying to control the risk of foreign governments having access to commercial / state secrets, kind of to some degree, it doesn't matter who owns the company as long as the information flow isn't necessarily going. Do you see what I mean? And so the structure matters.
Sense, but there's also a policing element to it. How do you police that going forward? Do you have the resources and the So, and so just to come back to what I was saying, that nobody from a deal perspective likes any of this additional conditionality because that introduces uncertainty and you've got a price accordingly, and that's not beneficial for either party. It obviously makes our lives more interesting from a pure legal perspective. There's more to navigate, but it's clearly not a help.
So how is this actually affecting deal making? Is it, I assume to some degree, private equity firms, certain deals or sectors maybe are not getting through their filter because they don't want to have to deal with this? Or does it get through their filter and then you have to check it out? Or does it get all the way down the line and suddenly, oh my goodness, we did not see this coming?
It's all three. So the first one, it's quite hard to prove the negative. What deals did not happen but for this? But certainly anecdotally, I can say there are some deals which might have happened but for this additional issue that I'm aware of. You know, just individually interacting with clients.
What kind of sectors or?
So unsurprisingly, tech. Yep. But there are others. And then on the second and third categories that you identified, certainly seen that, having to do a more complex clearance process with the consequent time delay and therefore risk that imposes as between the parties and risk that the parties then run out of patience or try and recut the deal or whatever it may be. So that certainly had an impact. And then now and again, I would say your third category is the least common, certainly within the PE industry, because people are very rigorous about understanding the risks before they go in. But now and again, you will have a regulator who doesn't behave the way everyone expected. And so now suddenly you've got a crisis on your hands that has to be addressed.
But you also mentioned monopolies, regulators looking out for monopolies and the roll-ups and so on. So how does the perspective on this differ across jurisdictions, and what are they actually trying to stop? Because the way I view competition law is that, you know, you shouldn't stop companies from getting big and controlling an industry. It's the monopolistic behavior that matters rather than scale or size per se.
Yes. And I'm not an antitrust / competition lawyer. So you're now going to get the amateur dabbler's view of this from a distance.
This is fun shack. It's private equity. We don't need to.
Enough. There is, I'm told by those who know what they're talking about, there is a fundamental shift in the philosophy of antitrust law that is unfolding. You know, historically, the focus has very much been on end consumer or end user protection. Now the focus is more on are the participants in the market creating a dominant position which can suppress innovation, suppress effective functioning of the market, even if it still results in cheaper prices to the end user, the consumer.
That's highly subjective, surely. Wow.
Yeah, smarter people than me have done a lot of academic research on this. So if you look at the current current FTC, there's a lot of thinking around that that's currently taking place. And so when you start looking at it from that perspective, something like a roll-up can be of concern because it can squeeze out competition in the market by dominating the market, even if the end user is still getting as good or better a deal than they previously had.
So I guess part of the argument there is, okay, we're rolling up, but we're still investing in R&D and all of that good stuff.
Yeah, and there was a case recently in the US where there was a really focus by the court off the back of this of overlapping directorships, and which it's not unusual legitimately for the private equity firm as the majority owner to put some of its own representatives on the board of the portfolio company. It's not unusual at all. But you've also got to think, if that private equity firm has investments elsewhere in the same industry, to your earlier point, what is the information flow like and what are their drivers like? And so that's also now come into focus as part of this.
Yeah, particularly since private equity firms are starting to kind of get more organized and structured and formal in the collaboration behind the scenes of portfolio companies and CEOs.
It's this maturing of the market that we talked about earlier.
Yeah. And so just to ask you about other areas that you probably don't deal with very often. I saw that the SEC came out with their ESG regulations last week, I think it was.
Yes. Plug for Deckard. We are very strong in ESG. Chris Field, personally, not so much. So again, amateur dabbler perspective here. A few certainties that we can say. Europe is very much in the lead in this from a regulatory perspective. That is a real advantage for Europe. A little bit different in the US. They are, you mentioned the SEC's, I would say, finally come out as compared with come out. Certainly behind the curve compared with Europe and thinking about how to regulate ESG. And the problem, as we've seen, is that at the time that they're doing it, has become a very politicized issue, very, very politicized issue. And there's clearly this pushback that you're seeing in the US against ESG. And that's interesting because ESG is a very broad church. The E and the S and the G are actually very different things when you think about it. You know, and so on the S side with DEI initiatives, that's a bit of a political lightning rod, excuse me, at the moment. Environmental, and when that comes up against energy and energy transition and how do you navigate through that, that's become a political hot rod. The governance maybe not as much, but it's all tarred by the same brush because of that all-encompassing acronym.
And so what about Deckard and your place in the market? What are your goals? What are your ambitions in terms of private equity advisory work?
To be the best. So alongside everybody else, no difference there. Differentiators in terms of Deckard. So a few things. So we've actually been very active in the private equity market pretty much since inception. We are currently celebrating our 40th year as an advisory firm, legal side, to the private equity industry. And I just want to say private equity is actually a slippery term these days. So what I mean by that is advising on leveraged buyouts. And we've been doing that since 1984, which relative to the age of the industry makes us one of the real pioneers, certainly on the advisory side. Just as we've touched on, there is a far greater private capital industry that has evolved, and the firm has and continues to be very strong in the asset management and financial services space more generally. And so I joke sometimes to say that the market is coming to us, in the sense of all of those trends that we've just touched on are helpful for where we are positioned and how we see ourselves growing, which is very much to be a preeminent provider, not only for leveraged buyouts, where we've had and continue to have a very strong mid-market practice and increasingly premium practice, but also across all the different strategies that our client base is now considering, whether that's credit, whether that's some form of listed vehicle, fund formation, restructuring, whatever it may be.
Internationally,
that's absolutely right. We have been tagged. Everyone likes to pigeonhole things. And so for better or worse, in most of the legal directories or legal commentary, we get tagged as, quote, one of the globalists. So we have historically been very global and we continue to be. And just an aside here, being global does not necessarily mean there is a correlation, but it's certainly not a causation, having offices in every single geography on the planet. You can be in every single geography on the planet and still not be global. You can be exactly many individual country-specific practices united under a common brand. That is not us at all.
Yeah, but you're strong, I noticed, in like Singapore and obviously Europe and North America and your New York.
Correct. That was an active decision. You know, we want to be very strong in the largest capital centers around the world. You've touched on a number of them. Yep. Obviously, Brexit has made it more challenging in terms of thinking about how you look at Europe. But fortuitously, we are positioned in all of the main geographies, in particular from a funds perspective. So, you know, offices, which we've had for many years in Luxembourg, we're now also in Dublin and Ireland. that's not accidental. We're tracking our clients very closely.
And so you've come in from the financing side and you're advising private equity clients. Where are you in the kind of the food chain, as it were, on that side of things?
We would like to see ourselves positioned at the premium end. And I think a number of the clients we work with attest to that. But we're certainly not as large as, say, a Kirkland or a Latham. So I think the...
Kirkland being your alma mater.
My alma mater, correct, yes, for many years. So I think the strategy is very much to be excellent at what we do rather than trying to be everything for everyone.
What are big buyout people looking for when they're appointing a legal advisor?
Number one, first and foremost, it is a relationship-driven business. You know, they want to be very comfortable with the people who they're working with because it's such a close and intense experience, you know, running a deal through to completion. So it's relationship-driven first and foremost. Secondly, they're looking for credentials. And credentials in the sense of you have done this before and you've encountered all the difficulties and you know how to navigate through those difficulties. And ideally, you've come up with an innovative solution which not only navigated through the difficulty, but actually enhanced the outcome. So credentials are hugely important.
Kind of like creative thinking.
And a lot of creative thinking is driven by experience.
Yeah.
And so, hence I come back to credentials. If you have done this 25 times before, the odds are you've seen pretty much every angle that there is to be seen. And then thirdly, and this comes back to you need to be correctly positioned. You need to be able to provide advice in all of the areas and across all of the issues that the client is going to be concerned about. And that's where you get levels of advice, because whilst it's important that you can cover off, say, for example, the actual real estate, what the US lovingly refer to as dirt lawyers, folk who actually do the conveyancing, That's probably not fundamental. What's more fundamental is if for example, it's a real estate financed, if it's real estate financing, can you do the finance work in what is a relatively specialist area? We have a leading ref practice. So yes, that's exactly what we do.
So it's the key relationship contact. And then do you in-house have access to all of the niche specialities?
Yes, and the right niche specialities, the ones that really make sure that the deal is going to happen. So across the M&A, across the financing, and across increasingly important, in addition to tax, is pure regulatory. And by that, I mean things like antitrust, foreign direct investment, to a certain extent these days, looking ahead and protecting liability and reputation and so forth, do you have certain types of litigation capability, whether that's white collar or in some cases having an understanding of mass torts class action on the defense side.
And presumably there's a pure size element. I mean, you've got to, particularly as we were saying, the industry is getting larger in terms of the firms that are there. Businesses tend to like working with other businesses, suppliers of a similar size. It gives them like comfort.
And what I've certainly seen over my years of practice is there's been somewhat of a shift. historically, and even today, the US is the single largest market globally. And that also, and in particular, is the case for legal services. The US legal services market is one or two orders of magnitude larger than any other legal services market on the planet. It's very interesting. When you look at legal services as an industry, it's a very, very geographically fragmented market. And the US, if not, it sits in the high 40%. And the next largest legal services market in the world is actually the UK, which sits just below 10%. So in the single digits, that gives you a sense of the difference. So historically, when our US-based client base was coming into Europe and we were coming into Europe alongside them, it was very much about making sure, to use US terminology, that the US advisors were quarterbacking the deal. What I've seen change over the years is as our client base has increasingly set up, you know, vast operations, we take Europe across Europe as a whole, and employed people who are local to those geographies, which is really important for deal sourcing, being plugged into the geography, that they have brought their own relationships, which are local legal relationships, with them. So increasingly, the skills and the work are being sourced directly into those geographies. And so hence, to your original point, why it's so important to have that geographic scale.
Okay, but to go against that, it does seem to look from a bird's eye perspective like these US-headquartered legal firms are becoming ever more dominant, even in large European transactions.
That's absolutely right. But equally, if you've looked, they've continued to grow through other geographies globally. And so then it becomes, and this is not unique to the legal profession, I think it cuts across all these industries, how do you balance it? There's an element of profitability involved in all of this. And so how do you ensure that you still remain a profitable, against your own metrics, a profitable organization, but still able to provide that breadth of service?
Yes.
And that's a bit of a tightrope that everyone walks.
Because there's a real infrastructure that's required. And particularly when no deals happen for 18 months, like we've seen recently, that's difficult. I suppose the other question there is recruitment and what they call the war for talent.
Absolutely.
You spend some time thinking about, how do we get the best young graduates? I mean, what's the average starting salary for a private equity? No, in fact, don't tell me that. It'll just make me question my career choices.
Private equity lawyer. I could spend the rest of this program discussing the intricacies of that. So let me try and keep it high level. Spend a lot of time thinking about this. In the New York market, there is a fairly standardized, certainly for the first 5-6 years of practice, pay scale that operates across all of the top firms. That is not necessarily the case in any other market, but that is the benchmark for other markets globally. And so there are a number of firms that choose to pay at that pay scale in any of their offices globally, which has historically distorted other markets around the world because the pay is that much higher than in those local markets. And so what you're increasingly seeing, including in the London market, is a bit of a bifurcation between primarily US firms that pay up at that very high scale. It's historically been called the Cravath scale because Cravath, very prestigious New York firm, has historically set that scale. And then in the UK, you may have heard this term, the magic circle, which is the historically dominant UK firms who pay at a slightly lower rate, but offer other, as they would describe it, other benefits, such as size in the local market, therefore the ability to train up their juniors, access to deals in the local market. And then you have a variety of firms who sit somewhere above or below those two data points. And so it is a very difficult path to walk in terms of what is the optimized pay versus the other benefits and advantages that you can offer young lawyers, and how then do you best promote that into the market as a whole?
And presumably the whole story about the upward growth of the business itself.
Correct. Everyone wants to be part of a winner. Yep. Everyone wants to be a success story. Yes. But also what increasingly through coming out of COVID, what's played into this is the whole work from home versus working in the office, flexible working. How do you set that up? Work environment, quality of work environment, access to work. All of these metrics feed into it.
I think that there are only two types of people in the world. There are early birds and there are night owls. And I am an early bird. I am razor sharp in the morning, but by 9 p.m., my brain is putty. And anecdotally, I understand that all of the work, the serious work on a deal gets done like after midnight or something like that. I'm sure it's not true, but you get the idea. There's this kind of macho culture that comes, how true is that?
I'm going to maintain the myth. Yes. It all happens after midnight. So what was interesting to me, you can maybe tell from the accent, I started my legal career many, many years ago in South Africa. And I guess it's because of the sunshine and so on. It is an early bird culture. I was one of the laggards. I am a night owl, to your point. I was one of the laggards and I just made it in time for an 8 a.m. start, and everyone would look at me sideways. Why had I arrived so late? And then I arrived in London and discovered that officially the start time at the firm that I joined then was 9:30 a.m. I was staggered. Half my day had already passed before I needed to. And then I realized how late it ran and it all made more sense. A lot of work does happen late into the evening, but it's waves. And again, that's part of when you're marketing to junior lawyers, you need to make sure that you control the waves correctly. There will be very intense times, but you don't want set after set after set, so you never get a chance to breathe.
Well, it's like a war story of your, the deal that sticks in your mind where you've really had to put in the hours and...
I mean, there've been many of them, but just one that springs to mind. I was involved in, it was pretty complicated at the time. Do you remember the mobile phone retailer, Phones For You?
Yeah.
Yes. And it was actually split between Providence Equity, which took the part that actually went on to be a better outcome, if I could put it that way. And then Doughty Hanson, no longer with us as a firm, that took the remainder of it. And so it was a pretty complicated transaction, and big founder, John Caldwell, big business. And there's obviously a lot of complexity when you're unpicking a business that has been run as a very intensely controlled founder-owned business, putting it into a more institutional private equity-run setting, at the same time splitting it into two simultaneously. And so, like all of these deals, you know, continue issues keep coming up one after the other, one after the other. And so it does become somewhat like a war of attrition as to how many all-nighters you can consistently do one day after the other and still be vaguely functional to make sure you hit a timing deadline.
Yeah, I couldn't do it. I'm glad I didn't become a lawyer, actually.
It is, to be fair, a young man's game. I've definitely learned that as I've got older. Yep. There is a sweet spot when you're of a certain age where you have the requisite skills and you have the stamina and drive to make sure that you can just push that through.
What is it that you really like about your job? What types of deals do you like doing? What part of the deal or do you like doing?
I think problem solving. That is it. I relish problem solving. And whether that's just a piece of pure advisory work where there's a discrete problem and I'm like, this is the answer. And people go, wow, we had not thought of that answer. That's really valuable. Thank you for that. Or it's deep into a deal where there are multiple problems that need resolution and you bring it all together and successfully deliver the deal. But ultimately, it's the problem solving. I think most lawyers have an academic slant to them deep down. You can't make your way through law school, all the way through law school, without some of that getting into you. And so, combination of problem solving and because we're all on the advisory side, a desperate need to please our clients. There we go.
Yes. And I see you're still you're involved with the London Business School.
I am on an ad hoc basis, yes, on lecturing on private equity. And also we as a firm, the London School of Economics hosts a very large alternative investment conference. They call it for students, but it's not just LSE students. It's students from across the world. I believe they have something like 4,000 or 5,000 applicants. It's become very large over the years. And we are the legal aspect of that again. And that again, it's a form of kind of training and mentoring and providing an insight into the industry, which I enjoy.
Yeah. Great. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing your perspectives from your report and your experience. It's been great fun.
Great. Thank you, Ross.
You've been listening to the Fund Shack Private Capital Podcast. Now, do me a favor, would you? Wherever you're listening or watching, please leave a like or a rating and make sure you subscribe. It really helps and I'd appreciate it. Fund Shack is another quality production of Linear B Group, the content and media provider for professional services and investment firms. Thanks for listening.